one is one reduction that we have for this agency. To pick up where Sheila was with the Staley v. Kitzhaber lawsuit, and just to boil this down, the U.S. Supreme Court has basically created an entitlement for developmental disability services, and that's what we're trying to incorporate here, is how we implement that. It has a very large price tag, but on the human side of this, these are people that have gone without services for many, many years, and it is a real benefit to them because they'll be able to have universal access for all clients. They'll have in-home supports if they need them, and for those that some of those that are in the most need, will actually be able to move them into homes, similar to what other clients may be receiving. The next item, the children's mental health, you'll see for $4 million. That one is really to move about 65 children out of the Oregon State Hospital and into the least restrictive environments out in the community. We are looking at that as a real opportunity. You do need to be aware that the cause of action with the Staley v. Kitzhaber lawsuit all ties back to a Supreme Court decision called Olmstead. And you will hear discussions about Olmstead as we go through this biennium. And basically the theory is that there are people out there who are in more restricted environments, for example, at the state hospital, who could be served in the community. And if that is their situation, that they should be served out in the community, or we are violating their rights under Medicaid law. So that is an area that, as we move clients out of the mental health, the institutions, the Oregon State Hospital, for example, that is in the back of our mind as we're trying to plan around these things.
Madam Chair, I can't let that comment pass without at least recognizing the irony of our last conversation, where you're talking about this case saying clients served in more restrictive environments and the need to move them into the community, otherwise we're violating their rights, and the discussion about Oregon Project Independence and keeping them in community-based versus moving them into a more restrictive situation.
Representative Johnson, and I do understand all the passion that's associated with this item, but if you want us to reconvene this during lunchtime.
Sorry, Madam Chairman.
Oh, we don't want that.
Madam Chair, the third bullet is the Oregon Children's Plan. I'm going to skip over that because you have a whole slide down the road that will talk about the Oregon Children's Plan in general. The next two are items that we believe, these are those packages we have less discretion over. The federal government has changed its rules on seclusion and restraint at mental health institutions. We have to comply with that, and it costs us more money. The next one is that we have some clients at the Oregon State Hospital that have hepatitis C, and we need to pay for their treatment. The final one is that the only reduction you do see in this budget is that we have eliminated inflationary increases for some of our largest mental health providers, where we think that this is not going to cause us an access issue. These clients are long-term, they've been there for a long time, and we expect that they will continue to serve our clients even if they have to tighten their belt here.
Thank you.
We'll now move to the State Office for Services to Children and Families. And from Department of Administrative Services, Dave Fazier will be presenting that part of it. This first slide, just in a nutshell, summarizes what this office does. It protects children, it helps find them safe permanent homes, and it provides safe care for children if they are unable to be in their own homes. Obviously, there are a lot of other issues that are involved with those, but those are the major functions of the agency. Federal funds pay a large share of this agency's costs, primarily foster care and adoption assistance. They get federal temporary assistance to needy families funds, TANF funds transferred from the Adult and Family Services Division. They match a number of their services with federal Medicaid dollars. And there is the Federal Social Services Block Grant, which also comes to this agency, which is used partly here and in several other agencies. The other funds is a small share. It includes client reimbursements, but notably, it also includes criminal fines and assessment account revenues that are transferred to this agency for child abuse assessment centers, domestic violence, and sexual abuse victims programs. As you can see here, there's been significant growth in this budget from 1995-97. Obviously, the pace slows from 99-01 to 2001-03. The next slide shows some of the environment in which the agency operates. Abuse reports are up significantly over the last decade. These are reports of child abuse, and the agency investigates those. Generally, about one-third of the number of reports turn into founded cases, that is, where the agency decides, yes, there has been some abuse or neglect. So the number of victims are up 38% over that same time period. So there are more demand, or there is more pressure on the agency to provide services. As with a number of other DHS agencies, this agency is also implementing some major system changes in terms of how they do business. There was a 1995 agreement that in lieu of a lawsuit by the Juvenile Rights Project, the state entered into agreement for what is now termed system of care. The issue is, how do you adequately provide care for the children that are in SCF's custody? Do you provide it based on what services are available, or based on what the child and family actually needs? So there, in connection with the system of care approach, there's an individual needs assessment and provision of specialized services, which may be more costly than what SCF would have otherwise provided. The agreement calls for that approach to be phased in statewide by June of 2003. So by the end of that biennium, that approach is to be in use in all counties in the state. The other major system change piece that the agency is dealing with is as a result of the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, which imposed some strict timelines in terms of how long kids could be in foster care before they needed to be moved out or put in otherwise permanent placements. It set timelines for termination of parental rights. There are added legal costs because there's more oversight by the judicial system, and there was a need for SCF to find more adoptive homes because the law was retroactive, and so they needed to go back and address the issues of some of the kids that had been in care for some time. The agency will be having an audit of their compliance with that this year, and so we should be able to get a sense of how well they are implementing the additional changes with the additional resources that they were provided in the last budget. The foster care caseloads have slowed in terms of a rate of growth. This chart shows that in July 2001, there's significant growth from July 1999, but that's not necessarily a change in the number of children in foster care. It's a change in the number of children in paid foster care. Because of some federal regulations, the agency expects to be paying more foster care homes, more relative foster care homes, than they had previously. So there is, it looks like a lot of growth, but without those extra 500 cases, the growth rate would only be about 3 or 4% between 99 and 2001. And then it's assumed to grow at a slower rate still over the next biennium. The agency has made significant gains in the number of adoption placements. There were additional resources given to the agency in the last couple of biennium for adoption placements, adoption staff. And they've been able to effectively implement that. And you can see there the number of adoption placements are up. That does create a budget issue because most of the adoptive placements require what's called adoption assistance payments for medically needy children or children with other special needs. And so that's a budget driver for this agency. This reiterates the issues. We've already touched on most of them. System of care, when during this biennium does it phase in, and what level of funding does it phase in? Has the agency been able to meet the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act requirements? The foster care and special rate foster care, which special rates are higher rates paid for more difficult children or children needing more intensive care. Those caseloads continue to grow. As the chart showed, the foster care overall, the growth rate has mitigated. The number of children that are needing special rates continues to increase, and so that's a budget issue for the agency. and then continued growth and adoption assistance. As I mentioned, as placements grow, more of those children need continuing assistance payments up to age 18.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, I'll be brief. On this chart, I just wanted to point out two key figures. The general fund for the governor's recommended budget is an 8.1% decrease from current service level. However, total funds is indicates a 1% decrease from current service level, indicating that we're maximizing use of other funds in lieu of general fund. Very briefly, the major budget issues that you will be discussing, I'm sure, during the budget process for SCF, the statewide system of care will be implemented under this budget by the end of the 2001-03 biennium. There is reduced funding for family treatment and family support team efforts. There is reduced flexibility in the foster care caseload. And there are some staffing reductions which we believe we can implement for economy's sake. One of the major philosophic changes, structure changes, that is integral to the governor's recommended budget in SCF is a change in philosophy, and a move to utilize resources to earlier in the pipeline on early intervention and prevention services to reduce actual caseload costs down the line. And additionally, there are changes in the criminal fines and assessment account program. The funding is to see SCF is current service level or above, but we are making some changes in how those proposing changes and how those allocations of those funds are made.
Sure. Will there be some kind of an assessment of that so we can understand who the winners and losers are as you reallocate?
Senator Trow, yes, we have a complete list of the funding levels and the current service level estimates for all of those uses of those funds. We'd be happy to get that to you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, I believe that in the public safety presentation, there's also a little bit of discussion about that.
Thank you for your brevity.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Rick Olson with Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm going to take you through a real quick and brief overview of the Health Division. The Health Division establishes policies and carries out activities designed to improve the health and safety of Oregonians. It monitors the health status of communities and the performance of healthcare systems and has a regulatory role in ensuring that public facilities, drinking water systems, healthcare facilities, and equipment meet state and federal requirements. Services are provided primarily through county health departments and other community organizations, and where there is no local provider, the Health Division provides direct services themselves. Only 8% of the Health Division's budget comes from the general fund. Other funds support 28% of the budget and comes primarily from fees and services charged, inspection fees, licensing fees, and those types of services. This particular budget, the governor's recommended budget, does include some fee increases, and we'll be discussing that in more detail during the budget hearings. The majority of the budget is federal funds, and of the $206 million federal funds, over half of that is considered non-limited funds. Similar to the food stamps, these funds come primarily from WIC, the U.S. Department of Agricultural Food Grant for Women, Infants, and Children. $77 million is for that program. Another $28 million comes from an infant formula rebate program that is part of the WIC as well. This slide gives you a historical perspective over the last three biennia as compared to the upcoming biennium. And although the overall budget has increased 59% since 1995-97. Most of the significant increases have occurred with general funds and other funds. federal funds have increased 88%, and other funds have increased 125%. And you'll notice there a slight decrease in the general fund governor's recommended budget when compared to the current biennium. And I'll let Dave talk a little bit about the governor's recommended budget.
Thank you again. I'll be brief. On this slide in particular, if you look at the general fund in the middle, I would highlight the 18.4% reduction from CSL, but total funds is a 1.7 million reduction, indicating again most economic use of other revenue sources other than general fund. As a brief overview, these are indicate the enhancements that the governor is proposing in his budget to tobacco prevention programs and a minority health database. Specifically, there will be more discussions, I'm sure, and some detail on the reductions that are proposed in the drinking water program. That is a reduction of general fund to be replaced by transfer of dollars from economic and community development, so it is not a reduction of the program, just the general fund. Oregon Children's Plan will be covering a little more in detail in a bit, but a slice of the money that funds that initiative comes from Health Division, from the Babies First program. There were serious consideration and decisions to reduce child fatality review, school-based health clinics, and perinatal and prenatal programs at OHSU.
And that's it for the Health Division.
Thank you very much.
We'll move on to the director's office. The director's office provides leadership and centralized business services for the divisions that make up the Department of Business Services. During the 1995-97 biennium, support services positions were transferred from the divisions to the director's office to reduce costs and improve efficiency and services. The department-wide support services include accounting, personnel and payroll, contract administration, budget coordination, building operations, and information systems. Here we see, again, a historical perspective over the last three biennia. The director's office budget has increased 87% since 1995-97. The most significant increase came during the 97-99, and as I said, it was during 1995-97 that most of these positions were moved from divisions into the director's office, and that accounts for most of that growth. The majority of the funding comes from other funds, the bulk of which are generated from assessments made to the divisions. I will point out here, you'll see a substantial growth in the federal funds and general funds in the governor's recommended budget. The majority of that has to do with the Medicaid management information systems. The state has committed over $4 million general fund and matched that with approximately $18 million federal fund for that system. As I said, the bulk of the other funds for the director's office comes from assessments to the divisions. It's important to point out that of the $150 million in assessments, nearly $48 million of that is from the general fund that come from the divisions to the director's office. Those are general fund dollars. And Kelly Friel from Department of Administrative Services join me here, and I'll let him discuss the governor's budget briefly.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I'm not even going to touch that slide. You can see the increases. Rick pretty much talked about the major policy issues that you have before you for the director's office, and that is the reorganization, which you will get more information on as that plan is completed. The second item is development of the Medicaid management system, medical management system. Over time, about 5 to 7 years, this system is going to cost about $125 million. This is the second phase. It's not an issue of whether we need to do it, it's how we want to do that particular project. The good news is that the feds participate in about 90% of the cost. Well, those are the policy issues for the director's office.
And with that, we'll move on to the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. OADAP is the primary state agency responsible for planning, contracting, and regulating Oregon's public alcohol and drug abuse prevention, treatment, and maintenance services. Following the 1999 legislative session, the office assumed responsibility for managing the statewide system of gambling prevention and treatment services. That is funded through lottery dollars. Those are the only lottery dollars the Department of Human Services receives. OADAP has no branch offices, but contracts primarily with county governments and other local providers for the direct delivery of services. The sources of funds, 41% come from the general fund and lottery. The primary source of other funds are the beer and wine tax, and also fines paid into the intoxicated driver program. And then a wide variety of funds are received from the federal government. Historically, you can see a substantial growth in the governor's recommended budget. The total budget has grown 90% since 1995-97. And again, I'll let Kelly talk about some of the items in the governor's recommended budget.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, you can see on the first slide, this is a budget of about $51 million. I believe if you listen to the first part of the presentation where they were talking about budget drivers, one of them is the abuse of alcohol and drugs. And so you can see one of the reasons why this particular budget was increased over time. And in fact, the last legislative session added $10 million of state resources in order to expand services. Under this slide, there are two policy issues you need to consider. One is continuation of that expansion. There's about $9.2 million to continue the residential rate increase. The emergency board heard issues on that. You'll have another opportunity to have more conversation on that later on. The second is the Oregon Children Plan, also includes about $10.5 million of resources to alcohol and drug for service to the parents of those children. And that's an expansion also. And finally, there are a number of reductions in this budget. We're trying to maintain the service capacity, but we're going to cut back on the amount of training and some of the other services we provide to the providers.
And that's it.
Well, thank you very much.
Sheila, take over for OMAP.
Now we get in.
Yes.
Just to comment on process, this is such good information, and it's being presented so hastily that I really regret it, and I wish we'd maybe spend another day doing it or something.
I've made a note of that.
Yeah, good.
Because there's others who would like to have more information, and I think recognizing the complexity of human services and all that's involved, I have noted that.
Good. Madam Chair. I believe you received a written request from this office for that.
Yes, you did. I did. Thank you.
The Office of Medical Assistance Program is the...
Excuse me, Ms. Baker. I want to back up because I think this is the first time that we've ever done this. Isn't this true? Where we've had this kind of overview?
We have done overviews in prior years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's the first time, Madam.
We'll call it Ways and Means
101.
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, as Kelly Friels mentioned, this is the first time that we've had the Department of Administrative Services staff here to more fully explain what's in the governor's budget.
We appreciate that opportunity, by the way, Madam Chair.
I thought this was the first.
Okay.
I'm getting a lot of additional questions. That's good.
Senator, we want those questions. Yes. We want the policies fully discussed.
And we like them to answer them. Office of Medical Assistance Program. This obviously is the big budget piece. The OMAP, as it's familiarly known, administers the Medicaid program, which probably most people refer to as the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Plan is somewhat broader than that, but a lot of people refer to the Medicaid program as the Oregon Health Plan. It also administers the state Children's Health Insurance Program and General Assistance Medical Programs. It oversees the physical medicine piece of the Oregon Health Plan. As we talked before, the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division has the mental health piece there. There are health services that are funded in OMAP's budget that are not part of the health plan. And as you can see on this, that's not an insignificant amount of money. It's almost $200 million general fund, or $200 million total fund, sorry. The health plan Medicaid piece obviously is the biggest part of the budget. Children's health insurance program is a relatively small piece. The non-OHP medical is basically two types of programs. One is for medically needy, for those persons who don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan but have significant medical costs and can spin down to an eligibility where the state can assist them with those costs. And then there are elderly people with incomes below 120% of the federal poverty level, which, depending on income, the state will pick up a part of their will pick up their Medicare premium. And again, depending on income, some of the deductibles or other medical costs that they have. Federal funds is a large share of OMAP's budget. Obviously, the Medicaid program is the majority of that. There are significant other funds in this agency. Primarily, that's from tobacco tax, 1996 ballot measure 4, which dedicated some tobacco tax funds to the Oregon Health Plan. And as you can see in this slide, in 97-99, the yellow piece increases. That's the other funds. That's as a result of Measure 4 and the tobacco tax expansion. There is considerable growth in this budget, 20% between 01-03 and 99-01. And Kelly Friels will talk about that increase in a moment. It's primarily due both to caseload changes and then changes in costs and utilization. But there has been significant growth over this time.
Madam Chair, the governor's budget for this particular program is the largest one that you're going to consider in this particular subcommittee of human resources, and probably the second largest budget the legislature is going to consider. It's over $1 billion in state resources and just a little under $3 billion of total fund resources. There are a couple of factors. For reasons for the increase, Sheila mentioned the cost growth, and I'm going to have a separate slide to talk more completely about that. And the second factor driving this budget is caseload growth or increased number of people utilizing these services. When you review this budget, you'll also find there's some structural changes. The plan was to have a managed care system. Right this biennium, we have about 70% of the eligible people eligible for services that are in a managed
what level they may fall on. The approach that we have taken in the governor's budget, and this gets back to having to ration back based on a limited budget, is that we have eliminated the services for OPI with the understanding that those clients have higher incomes and may therefore have more opportunities to provide for their own care. And with levels 15 through 17, based on the criteria that we have in front of us, those are the least impaired clients in our system. And if we have to reduce this budget back, we would rather maintain services for critically impaired clients.
Just a quick follow-up. But then I would like to, there's a lot of questions surrounding this, and I want to make a set. Do you have a one-pager that talks about level of income and risk factors, or something that you can give to members of this body? Because this is a subject that is very important and that we're all very, very interested in. And I know members will have a lot of questions, but in the essence of time, I think if you can get that to this body,
yes,
I'd appreciate
Madam Chair.
It.
Mm-hmm. We can get something like that.
The impairments involved.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I'll let you have your question, and then we'll move on.
Thank you. I'm just curious. You keep on referring to if we have to do this, make this budget. I mean, this is the governor's budget. I'm assuming that he believes that this is the appropriate way to go. And I'm just curious where he thinks, you know, we're going to find the additional dollars or something to do this. If these are his choices and his programmatic choices, we seem to be couching it as if, you know, there's some other options, and I'm just, you must think there are other options or something.
Madam Chair, Representative Hill, if I have characterized that, I am incorrect. We have to make these choices based on the resource limits that we are at. No one, including the governor, wants to make these choices. So if I've said we have to make them, that's what I'm referring to, that we have limited resources, and these are the recommendations of how we would balance this budget.
Representative Patrick.
I just had a question. I didn't notice in the LFO analysis or in the BAM or DAS analysis in regards to the nursing home rebasing. And my understanding is that we have some obligation to do that. I looked kind of ahead because we have your picture on your next slide, but I'm wondering why that's not included in the major budget issue, since I'm understanding it's about $15 million that there's a hole in and no rebasing's been done. LFO or debt or BAM didn't include that, and I'm wondering if we have a hole that we're not aware of in this particular budget that's fairly large, and why that's not included.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Representative Patridge, under past practice, we have had a process that was called the rebasing model.
Right.
And that has grown out of a Boren Amendment, which was repealed by Congress as part of the Balanced Budget Act.
Okay.
Several years ago. That Boren Amendment required that we incorporate a rebasing model for nursing homes, which basically says that at the end of this period, we will look back at what nursing facility costs were for the previous 2 years, and we will bring the base up from that point forward and inflate it into the future. Now that the Boren Amendment has been repealed by Congress, that exists in administrative rule only. It is not a statutory requirement. So what we have done in this budget is that we would expect, or what we have built into the budget, is that the nursing facilities receive a medical inflation factor, which is our highest level inflation, unless you qualify under some other criteria. For example, the Oregon Health Plan, which has a statutory requirement that we pay back costs. So what we have done with this budget is we have not included the cost of rebasing. Yes, my understanding is that it is about $15 million. We have not included that in our current service level into the next plan. We've limited it to the 4.6%.
So just so I understand, you guys are ignoring the administrative rule that requires that by the department. But so you're ignoring the administrative rule, even though you guys have required it in the budget analysis. So there is a hole that that your office is bound to fill as part of the budget process in order to have a balanced budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Patridge, we would not look at administrative rule as needing to be filled. That is something that the agency can change during the course of a biennium.
But it hasn't been changed.
It has not been changed at this point.
Thank you.
The last item that you'll see on, actually the two, when we've got two more that are fairly important. The fifth item you'll see on here is that we have proposed restructuring the rates for community-based care providers, which is primarily the assisted living facilities, the RCFs, and the adult foster homes. The system as it currently is for those three providers, even though they may serve clients that are basically the same, they get paid at varying rates, with the assisted living rate being the highest among the three, even though they may have a same client. So if you looked at one client with the same impairment levels, these different providers are going to be, under current law, be receiving completely different rates. What we propose with this is to flatten that rate so that we limit it for all clients, and then we have specific add-ons for services that the client may need. The sixth bullet there, which we will have more discussions about, is that there's a federal loophole under current Medicaid law, which is called the Medicare upper limit. It involves nursing facility rates and how much the states can pay and a cap that's provided. The loophole basically allows the state of Oregon, because we have an approved plan to do so, to recapture to the tune of $67 million of Medicaid funds that we can then use for the things that we desire in this state. I will let you know, though, that the federal government is well aware of this issue. They have chosen to closed this loophole and have provided the state of Oregon a five-year phase down so at the end of 5 years, we will not have these resources at all.
That's the fuzzy transaction.
That would be one way of referring to it, Representative.
Madam Chair, did we use this last biennium? How many years do we have in that 5 years to close it down?
Madam Chair, Senator Tro, we actually started this in the 97-99 biennium. During the 2000-2001 budget period, I'm sorry, the 2001-2003, so for the first state fiscal year, which would be July 1 of 2001 through June 30 of 2002, we will have full funding for that first year. The second year, we will get 75% of that first year's funding, and it decreases by 25% every year thereafter. Correct. And so we will have some money of this during the 2003-2005 budget, and I believe nothing of this in the 2003-2005 or very, very small. Madam Chair, that finishes SDS.
Thank you.
Not quite. I have a few budget issues, and George has mentioned a number of them. As he indicated, the governor's budget is below the current service level. There is are reductions to OPI, Medicaid long-term care. George mentioned the community-based rate restructuring. I would add one footnote to what he said, and that is that we are trying in this, or the governor is trying in this rate restructuring, to move more toward linking compensation or payment based on impairment levels of clients rather than simply tying them to the type of facility a client goes into. I've noted here the supply of client-employed providers. There is significant turnover in this employment area. These are folks that come into persons' homes to assist them with their needs. I would also note that the public passed Measure 99, which establishes a commission that would be the employer of record for these client-employed providers. How that plays out remains to be seen. There is no budgetary, there's no money in the governor's recommended budget to implement Measure 99 at all. Nursing facility financial health, back in the chart that I showed you some moments ago, you saw that nursing facility caseload was declining. That has continued to occur and is expected to continue to occur. And with it, there are a number of persons who are concerned about the financial health of nursing facilities. Representative Patridge asked about rebasing, but suffice it to say that that's an issue that will bear some examination. Quality of care, this is nothing new for this system. This is always an issue. There are concerns both about nursing facility quality of care, given the financial health, as well as assisted living facilities. Whenever there is extreme growth in one part of the system, naturally there are concerns about quality of care. George mentioned that Medicare upper limit payments would be phased out. That really doesn't affect us much during the upcoming biennium, but it will thereafter. In the 99 session, the legislature passed or provided a policy package to the Senior and Disabled Services Division and the Vocational Rehabilitation Division related to the employment of persons with disabilities. My recommendation to you, Madam Chair, is that the subcommittee look at that program, give it some attention to see how it's going. I would also note that there are a number of other initiatives within the department that relate to the employment of persons with disabilities, and a number of changes federally in that area that are important to look at. And finally, future senior and disabled population increases. I will leave you with one last thought, that even though some of you are term limited and will be term limited, that this is a system that needs some planning out into the future. As I noted it a moment ago, we saw significant budget growth right in this area between 1985 and the year 2000. And you can see that out in here, when the 75 to 84-year-olds or people like me reach that age group, we are going to see a significant stress on the system that needs to be planned for, I think, fairly soon. With that, I'm going to turn my part of the presentation over to Sheila Baker, who will begin her discussion of the mental health and developmental disability services.
One moment, Mr. Britton. I have a question from Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The ramping down of the funding for what I have heard characterized as aging in place services is going to have some fairly large implications for healthcare systems and geriatric care systems elsewhere in the system. What we're really doing here is displacing programs that have kept people in their own homes, the Project Independence dollars, the OPI program. And I don't really see a place in the budget those services are being picked up. So I see us displacing people from their homes who are in that age bracket. And I don't really see a concomitant transfer of ability to systems elsewhere in the senior and disabled program that'll pick up that demand. Am I missing something here?
I think that is a fair characterization of the situation.
Well, Madam Chairman, we've spent probably a decade building the capacity to keep people in their homes through home visit health care systems, through Meals on Wheels, and a whole host of a suite of in-home delivery services, in-home systems that are far less expensive than anything we can do in an institution, for instance. And the two benefits are that, or there's multiple benefits, but some that are obvious are that there's a maintenance of the integrity of the community, because seniors live in their own homes. There's a maintenance of the sense of identity for the senior, because they're not forced out of their home and into a nursing home system. The costs are clearly lower, because even at the entry level in those residence facilities, costs are quite high in comparison to living in your own home. They may not be adequate compensation for the home operator, but they're a lot more than living in a home, for instance, that might be wholly owned by the senior. And I just am worried that it's the old, for the want of a horseshoe, the battle is lost. And that's going to be true certainly for seniors who may not get, you know, a Meals on Wheels visitation or a visit by a home health care nurse or hospice services delivered at home and a whole host of other things. And I just wondered if that doesn't reflect a major reversal in our whole aging-in-place philosophy and system of senior health care in Oregon. It seems to me that it's an abandonment.
I agree with you. I just want to correct one piece of it, because I totally agree. You mentioned over a decade. I was in this building over on the other side, and this has been a 30-year involvement. It's not a decade of Project Independence and Meals on Wheels and those kinds of programs were started when I was with Community Action, when I was on the staff for the Oregon Economic Opportunity Office. So this is very, these are some things that I was involved in helping to develop some 30 odd years ago. And it was the movement of Oregon then, and we were very proud to be the state that led the nation in talking about keeping the elderly in their homes and making it possible to have services brought to them. So you're right, and it's, and yet at the other, we've got a serious budget issue, and I think it's going to take all of us to work together to try to make sure we keep our seniors healthy in the state.
Madam Chairman, the
you're touching a very hot emotional button of mine. I have to.
Well, I don't have a disrespect, Madam Chairman. Two observations. One is that I am certainly not the youngest member of the Senate, but in terms of ways and means, our wing in the Senate was referred to as the geriatric, the geritol.
I don't understand that at all.
So I apologize if I don't have all of the legislative history. I know it's been a long time evolving. That's why the reversal seems to me to be a major policy shift.
Yes. I don't want to belabor this because we do have to move on, and you're going to get me to crying pretty soon because it is, you know, I am part of that geriatric group, even though I'm on the House side.
You can have company. Madam Chair, one thing that was particularly useful in one of the presentations yesterday was a summary of the presenters, and if it would be possible to make that available to those of us that are going to have follow-on questions and are not familiar with your names, and I apologize, but if you could make that available, that would be great, and telephone
the person. That's possible. Welcome.
Thank you,
Ms. Baker.
Thank you. I am Sheila Baker, Legislative Fiscal Office, and we will make that available. The good news is you're a quarter of the way through the presentation. The bad news is we've already used over half your time, so we will talk faster. The next agency up is a discussion of the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. I will, in the interest of time, refer to it sometimes as MHDDSD. Not that that's a lot shorter, but a little bit. They have two major service elements, and the agency is roughly 50-50 in terms of budgeting between those two service systems. The first is mental health services, and they have a range of services with community services, particularly through the Oregon Health Plan. The mental health piece of the Oregon Health Plan is in this budget. There are other community services for non-Medicaid persons, and acute care facilities and psychiatric facilities in the community, and then they operate the Oregon State Hospital and the Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center as state-operated facilities for the most, those needing the most intensive services. The other part of the system that they operate is for developmental disability services, and again, there is a range of community services, residential, vocational, educational services, and then they operate at this point one state-operated facility, the Eastern Oregon Training Center, which has 60 beds. General fund supports about half of mental health's budget. The other funds primarily come from the Medicaid upper limit, which was discussed earlier. That's a pure fund shift in this budget. There's no program impact from that. The agency provides fee-for-service under the Oregon Health Plan for mental health services, and there are patient resources which also contribute to those other funds. As you can see there, there's been significant growth in this budget over the past few biennium, primarily as a result of the Oregon Health Plan, and then in this 2001-03 proposed budget as a result of increased expenditures for developmental disability services as a result of a settlement agreement for a lawsuit, which we'll talk about a little bit later. As was mentioned earlier, within the mental health budget, there's a total of $146 million general fund for Oregon Health Plan services, and that's $380 million total fund. So it's general fund and Medicaid match primarily. Over the past decade, two decades, mental health has made major shifts to community services, both in the mental health side and on the services for developmental disabilities. Two projects or two elements that you will hear a lot about, obviously, are the Oregon Health Plan, and this just summarizes how that was phased in for mental health services, which was a different phase-in schedule than for physical medicine services. And then what is called the Developmental Disability Long-Range Plan, which was the plan that closed Fairview and moved those residents to group homes and used money that would have otherwise been spent at Fairview to pay for regional backup services, serve some people on the waiting list, increase direct care wages. And there's a budget impact there for that. You will hear more about each of those in the Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee, because there are continuing issues on both of those. But as a result of those efforts and other efforts in the agency, most program services are now community-based. You can see on the mental health side, over almost 75% of their budget goes to either Oregon Health Plan or other community services. And the services for developmentally disabled persons, almost 85% of that money goes out to the community. So it's not a state facility mental health system or a state facility services for developmentally disabled. It's very much tied into the community, which raises some issues in terms of supporting those community services, managing them, getting information back, and then ensuring accountability. What we've identified as the major issues in this agency include, under mental health services, access to services for the adults and children who aren't eligible for Medicaid, who aren't eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Over time, as more resources have gone to the Oregon Health Plan and for other fee-for-service Medicaid services that leverage federal funds, there's been less general fund allocated for those persons who aren't Medicaid eligible. And, of course, the need for mental health services is not restricted to Medicaid-eligible persons, so that's a continuing issue in the agency. The mental health service system has to deal with persons who are committed to it through the civil or criminal courts, and that's a caseload issue, particularly at Oregon State Hospital. How do you manage those people? How do you treat those people effectively? And then the state hospital, although it is a relatively small share of the budget, there are continuing issues about what are the costs to provide those services. Obviously, drugs is the cost of drugs and pharmaceuticals is a issue at the state hospital, and then the quality of care, because this is a very intensive services required at the state hospital. On the developmental disability side, because the system is so heavily provided at the community level, provider wages and staff turnover, particularly in homes for residential homes for developmentally disabled, are an issue. The legislature has tried to address that in the past, but it is a continuing issue, and you will hear a lot about that this session. Because the state has so significantly reduced its institutional capacity to serve developmentally disabled persons by downsizing and then eventually closing Fairview with only 60 beds available at the training center in Eastern Oregon, at the local level, the effort is to manage services so that folks don't need to go to an institutional placement. And so we call those diversion caseloads, diverting folks from the institutions and providing community or in-home services. But that, again, there's a growing area of need there, and it's a budget driver for this agency. And then probably most significantly in this budget, the settlement agreement of the Staley versus Kitts Haber lawsuit, which in a nutshell said that persons with developmental disabilities who are eligible for Medicaid service need to get those services in a timely manner and in a least restrictive setting that can adequately serve them. To address those issues, the state has agreed to phase in additional residential and in-home and community services for both adults and children. And so that has a significant cost in this budget and over the next few biennium.
Madam Chair, I just wonder if the possibility they could get us a list, I mean, a definition of development disability. I mean, someplace along the line
certainly
we could get that.
Madam Chair and Senator Duncan, we can do that. I would also refer all members, if you want additional detail, realizing that we're going real high level here, there is additional detail in our printed LFO analysis that talks about the more definition of what the program is and how services are delivered in each of these agencies.
Madam Chair.
Just
quickly, there's nothing in this budget for any punitive amounts under this Staley settlement, is there?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, not that I'm aware of.
When you say punitive,
it was all just to implement new services. It wasn't for any retroactive or of that nature.
That's my understanding. There are some amounts in there to provide services for the persons who brought the lawsuit.
Certainly.
But there aren't punitive damages, excuse me. And then the last item on this slide, the Damish and Fairview properties, they have both been closed as institutions, and the Department of Administrative Services is responsible for selling those. There are significant issues in terms of infrastructure and how those properties will be used, and so we don't have a sale imminent on either of those, but there will be, again, considerable discussion during the legislative session on the plans for those.
What's that mean, problems with infrastructure like asbestos or environmental or what? I don't understand what it means.
Madam Chair, generally, for example, at Fairview, how do you get city water out there? That kind of thing.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Yee.
Thank you. I have a question on Oregon Health Plan. Oregon Health Plan was a demonstration project approved by federal government as a waiver. And at the time of the waiver, the condition of the waiver is that it would not cost more than what it would have been without incorporating in the Oregon Health Plan. So I want to know, what is federal government's criteria in evaluating the Oregon Health Plan?
Senator, we're going to come to OMAP. We haven't got there yet.
We haven't got there yet.
Mental health. We haven't got there quite yet.
And Madam Chair, Senator Yee, even when we get to OMAP, I would beg that we defer that and have the agency come back with a discussion of that and better define what kind of methodology they have in terms of calculating the cost neutrality of that.
Yes, because you mentioned the cost has increased 70% since 95, and what is this, 19% since 2 years ago. So the cost has really increased, and one of the conditions was it's supposed to be budget neutral. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I'll pick up and I will skip over the first slide, which is really overview information, and jump to the next one, which is the major budget issues. The first five of which that you will see are additions, and the last one is one reduction that we have for this agency. To pick up
the same activities that are in the current law. There's additional support for Oregon Plan and watershed restoration activities in the governor's recommended budget. There's an effort that you'll hear a little more about of institutionalizing the Oregon Plan by providing some more support services to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And then there are some other packages included in budgets to help the Oregon Plan, such as additional monitoring for Senate Bill 1010 in the Department of Ag, the addition of some riparian specialists in the Department of Forestry, and the continuation of positions used for development of total maximum daily loads in the Willamette Basin for Department of Environmental Quality.
And then there are some other priorities that the governor has identified in his budget, both new initiatives and then efforts to restore shortfalls that are based on fee revenue shortfalls from various fees in certain agencies. A lot of these priorities are funded within the program area itself or within an agency. For example, the Water Resources Department has made some base budget reductions and then moved that money to new initiatives such as the Stewardship and Supply Initiative, and so it's sort of internally funded. One of the biggest sources of revenue now for the natural resource program area from the state is the ballot measure 66 revenues. The latest forecast we have from December, last December, is that there will be $90.4 million available for natural resource programs from measure 66. That ballot measure was passed in November of 98, and it dedicates 15% of lottery revenues to parks and salmon. Half of the amount is to be provided to parks and half for salmon efforts. This is about a $3.3 million increase from 1999 levels. So of the new revenue, this means that $45.2 million of new revenue will be available for parks in these categories, and the same amount for salmon and watersheds. In the governor's recommended budget, these the $45.2 million for salmon is provided primarily to OWEB, but also to the Department of Agriculture, to the Oregon State Police for Fish and Wildlife Enforcement, and to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, another requirement of Measure 66 is that at least 65% of the money provided to for salmon and watersheds is to be used for capital expenditures. And last session, the legislature defined capital expenditures, and we will talk a little bit more about that today. But based on that split, that requires that at least $29.4 million of this new revenue be used for capital expenditure projects, which leaves a maximum of $15.8 million for operational expenses, which includes administration, staff, and non-capital kinds of grants, like an education grant or something like that.
I'm sure. Is that all statutory, or is that amendment of the Constitution?
Madam Chair, Senator Tro, most of that is constitutional. The definitions of what a capital expenditure is statutory, but the split and the requirement that at least 65% be used for those is a constitutional change. In the governor's recommended budget, this is the proposed split of that of Measure 66 revenues. It includes $3 million of carry-forward money in the local parks, local park grants portion of the budget. But this is the split between administration operations, facility repair and maintenance, local park grants, and land acquisition. For the salmon and watershed portion of the money, again, this shows the split between that's in the governor's recommended budget between capital projects and operations, split on that 65-35% basis. What is not shown in here is the fact that the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board does have that carry-forward amount that I described earlier. And this basically represents monies that have been committed by OWEB from 9901 allocations of the lottery, but because of the timing and when they released those two specific grant projects would not be able to be completely spent during the current biennium, so they need the limitation for the next biennium. This graph shows where Measure 66 funds for salmon and watersheds are proposed to go in the 0103 biennium compared to where they went in 9901. Again, revenues are up slightly for salmon and watersheds from about $43.5 million to $45.2 million. And this shows that the bulk of the money, of course, is going to OWEB because they were identified as the single agency responsible for the administration of these of the Measure 66 funds for salmon and watersheds. In the case of agriculture, the governor's recommended budget basically maintains the level of support provided in 1999 for weed control grants and for support of soil and water conservation districts. The slight drop between the two amounts is due to a fund shift that the weed control program was also, in addition to grants, it also included some staff support, and that staff support has been shifted to general fund in the governor's recommended budget. For DEQ, the change here is from in 1999, DEQ received lottery fund support for what is known as the Oregon Plan Steelhead Supplement positions. In the 0103 budget proposed by the governor, those positions are maintained, but they're shifted to general fund. And the $200,000 that you see on this chart, it represents monies provided to DEQ for the Lower Columbia Estuary Program. And this is a program that is a bi-state type of program where Oregon puts in some money, Washington puts in money, and they do projects in the lower Columbia Estuary. In forestry does not receive any lottery, Measure 66 lottery funds in the 0103 biennium. Again, these were steelhead supplement positions that were funded last biennium and are now being shifted to general fund. The positions continue, but their funding source has been changed. The fish and wildlife funds, Oregon plan positions within the Department of Fish and Wildlife are also shifted to general fund in the governor's budget. About $1.7 million remains, however, to support fish and wildlife activities with the Measure 66 funds. The state police funding is increased slightly. This amount of funding supports 15 fish and wildlife enforcement officers, as well as some capital outlay for those officers, basically state police vehicles. Due to salary roll-up costs within the state police Fish and Wildlife Division, however, that division is anticipated to lose 21 positions in the governor's recommended budget. Seven of those 21 are due to insufficient lottery funds to support the number of positions approved in the last budget. And the total amount for the Watershed Enhancement Board includes both dollars for operations and for capital expenditures. In 1999, OWEB received about $5.1 million in lottery funds for operational costs, and that's been increased to $8.6 million in 0103. Part of the reason for that is that OWEB also received $3.7 million of general fund in the 99 biennium, and that money has been eliminated from the budget and used primarily to fund some of these other steelhead supplement positions in other agencies. So that's the source of that fund shift for those. In addition to the use of general fund, these are this is a list of the governor's priorities using additional general fund in the 0103 biennium. The first one on this list is not all within the natural resource program area. It's a combined effort between the Department of Agriculture and the Tourism Commission, which is part of the Economic and Community Development Department, which is a $3 million combined effort to do a joint Brand Oregon agriculture tourism marketing campaign in the next biennium. And the rest of these we will describe in more detail when we get into specific agency budgets, except for the water resources ones, which provides about $500,000 for the stewardship and supply effort and $500,000 to continue the Klamath Basin adjudication. There are several major issues in the governor's budget. As we've been trying to describe, there's a number of fund shifts going on, a general fund redirection within agencies, and the distribution of Measure 66 revenues, which will be a subject for the legislature to discuss whether that distribution should be maintained or changed. There's an issue about the level of state support for Oregon Plan activity. The Willamette, the level of support provided for Willamette River Basin restoration efforts. There are a number of fee increases in the governor's recommended budget in the Department of Environmental Quality. The Fish and Wildlife Department has a sunset on their fee increase from 1999 that will affect their program if that sunset is not removed. Parks has camping and day use fee increases included in the governor's recommended budget. There's no state support for county fairs, which is always a concern of the legislature over the past, well, at least over the past several biennia that I've been doing this. And then there's a continuation of the Oregon Livability Initiative, not only a continuation, but a slightly new direction in it in trying to bring in some rural development into the livability issue. So these are things that the legislature will definitely be discussing during this session. So that was the overview of the program area. Now we'd like to get into a couple of major agencies with some more details. The Department of Fish and Wildlife is one of the natural resource program area's major agencies. It has more FTE than any other agency in the program area. In fact, about a fourth of the total FTE of the whole area are within the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The department's revenues are primarily from fees and federal funds. The general fund that you see here of about $20 million is used primarily in the fish division. About $14 million of that is fish division support. Most of that goes to propagation, which is the hatchery program, and a smaller amount goes for natural production activities, which are more related to Oregon Plan type work. The Wildlife Division, Habitat Division, and Agency Administration each uses about $2 million of general fund. This remaining amount of lottery funds in the governor's recommended budget of $1.7 million are used in the natural production program within the fish division. The primary source of other funds revenues are hunter and angling licenses. There's about $65 million included in the 0103 budget from hunting and fishing licenses. And this includes about roughly $5 million related to the sunset, removing the sunset on that 1999 fee increase that was approved. And the large amount of federal funds are from primarily from the National Marine Fisheries Service, about $30 million of that, the Corps of Engineers, Bonneville Power, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you. I just had a question. Has the legislation been introduced that would remove the sunset?
Madam Chair, Representative Bowman, yes, it has. I've seen the bill. I'm not sure what number it is, but we could get that for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
When you look at the major program areas within the department, I separated out fish propagation here just simply because it's so large, but it is part of the fish division. So the fish division by itself makes up over half of the total agency's expenditures. In addition to the propagation program, the fish division includes the natural production, which is basically the management of trout, warm water fish, steelhead, and salmon production. It includes the marine resources program, which is regulation and assessment of commercial fisheries. And you've probably been hearing a lot of news in that area because of the ground fish quotas that are being imposed on the state and other activities on the coast.
Excuse me, Mr. Rocco. Representative Hayden has a question.
On fish propagation, how much of that is purchased from private contractors?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'll have to get back to you on that. I know there's a package in the budget that would include an additional general fund amount for purchases of trout from private companies. And there was a bill passed last session that required a phase-in to have additional purchases made from private aquaculture companies. So,
10%?
I'm not sure. You know, Linda?
Well, we'll go on to that later. You had showed us a previous slide that said $200,000 in purchases.
That is the package that is in the budget to enhance that whole purchase of live trout. And I believe it's $172,000 exactly that the governor has proposed to add to whatever base program the agency has.
But, that's an add-on.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the other major fish division program is what's called the Interjurisdictional Fisheries Program. And basically, this is the Columbia River program and intergovernmental type activities that the Department of Fish and Wildlife conducts with the federal government and other states in our area. The propagation program here represents expenditures in the state's 34 hatcheries and satellites, and it produces about 75.5 million salmon, steelhead, and trout every year. The Wildlife Division consists of three major programs: the Game, Habitat, and Diversity programs. Agency administration includes the director's office, the information and education section, and the point of sale licensing system support. And state police is on here because the department provides contracts with the state police for enforcement services. And there's about $10.9 million in the governor's recommended budget for these services, and that will support about 56 officers in the 0103 budget. To show you that over time, how the department's expenditures have changed, we've included this chart. You can see there's a slightly greater reliance on federal funds over the past several biennia, and this is due to additional resources from the National Marine Fisheries Service. Some people believe they're not paying enough for some of the problems they've caused, but they are starting to pay more and provide some more funding for activities for the department. The other funds has fluctuated a bit due to changes in the fee revenues. The total increases, I think, from the mid-90s on are again related to Oregon Plan efforts and the ramping up of certain activities in that area. And now I'd like to invite Linda Gilbert up from Budget Management. We're trying to, as you've seen in the past, we're trying to share some of this discussion. And Linda's she's had it easy so far because I've had to do all this talking. So now it's her chance.
Thank you, Mr. Rocco. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I am the budget analyst for Fish and Wildlife. And I'm here to discuss the budget and policy issues that were at work when the governor's budget was developed. I'd like to give some overall context for all of the natural resource agencies with respect to guiding principles in putting together the natural resource agency budgets. First of all, there were essentially two. One was to find ways to invest in the future in the context of the statewide resource constraints, about which you've already heard a great deal, of course, with this particularly tight budget. And within the invest in the future concept, there were a couple of different areas. As Mr. Rocco has already mentioned, there's an attempt to stabilize or institutionalize the Oregon Plan, and also there are dollars in the budget to fund clean water initiatives. Finally, there was also a goal of filling or partially filling budget holes or shortfalls from current service level budgets that had developed. As Mr. Rocco said earlier, we also attempted to self-fund within all of the natural resource agencies. That in some cases, natural resource agencies took cuts or reductions to base programs in order to fund other initiatives that fell within the budget principles. And I will now discuss the fish and wildlife budget specifically. First of all, with what's in it, and second, some of the reductions that were taken. As you know, the 1999 legislature approved an increase in hunting and fishing license and tag fees. This has a January 2002 sunset. The governor has proposed repealing the sunset, and the difference there is $4.6 million of other funds. If the sunset stays in effect, there would be a shortfall of $4.6 million in other funds. The budget also proposes fund shifting, thank you, from other to general funds on several positions throughout the agency, and these are positions that have been held vacant when they were on other funds because increases in revenue or the rate of increase in revenues to the agency have not kept up with the rate of increase in inflation and salary costs over a period of years. These fund shifts occur pretty much throughout the agency. It's a total of $1.9 million in general fund. The 1999 legislature also provided $1.1 million in general fund to the agency on a one-time basis. And the concept was that in as much as the fee increase had a sunset so that the 2000 legislature could revisit the issue, the 2001 legislature would also revisit the issue of the one-time general funding. the governor's proposed budget, because it repeals the sunset on the fee increase, also includes or adds back the $1.1 million in general funding. And finally, part of the Oregon plan funding that had been in the Fish and Wildlife budget has been swapped out for general fund with OWEB. So this was an even swap, and it was about $2 million. In addition, there's an enhancement package for Oregon plan type activities that adds another $500,000 for Oregon plan to Fish and Wildlife. What's not in the budget, first of all, hatchery closures. There was a reduction of about $840,000 that involved reduction or elimination of production from three hatcheries around the state. There are also reductions, services and supplies reductions in hatchery maintenance. Capital improvements in hatcheries has been reduced. Fish screening services and supplies is reduced, and cormorant hazing is also reduced out of the budget.
Excuse me.
Madam Chair, forgive me, I just didn't hear you. You said something about three hatcheries, and I didn't hear it.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, three hatcheries are essentially closed. Either production is reduced or completely eliminated in three hatcheries.
Which three are those?
They are the Trask Hatchery, Rock Creek, and Butte Falls.
Thank you.
Linda, if you could perhaps pull your microphone a little bit closer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk a little louder.
Okay.
About 70% of the eligible people eligible for services that are in a managed care system, we're expecting that to decline and move to a larger percentage of fee-for-service clients in the system. As Sheila also pointed out, this budget does include tobacco tax resources to finance it. The governor's budget assumed that the 10-cent cigarette tax surcharge that was scheduled to sunset January of 2002 will continue.
Madam Chair, what does that mean, shift to fee for service?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, there are two methods to receive services under our medical model. One is a managed care system where a plan absorbs the risks of all the costs. We pay them a set amount each month.
Okay.
And the other is you just are paid based on the service.
Got it.
Or did cigarette tax. There are a number of reductions in this budget also, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We are, in this budget, assuming that the consumer or the CPI for some of the fee-for-service providers, primarily the non-hospital providers, will be cut in half. So instead of those providers receiving a 4.6% biennial increase, that would be reduced down to about a 2.3% increase. Again, those for primarily non-hospital providers. There are a number of minor drug actions that are assumed in this budget. We're also assuming that when we did the forecast of caseload, we're taking a very restrictive approach as to what those assumptions are. And finally, we're reducing funding for, we call them type B hospitals. These are small urban hospitals where in the past have been reimbursed based on their costs. And in this scenario, some of them, the ones that are the healthiest, would no longer receive a cost-based reimbursement. They would have seen the same reimbursement as other hospitals.
Could you give an example?
Example of a type B hospital.
Type B hospital.
These hospitals are primarily those that are under 50 beds and I think less than 30 miles from another major hospital. And to be even more specific,
I thought more than 30 miles.
Maybe it is, Senator Yee.
Could you provide this panel with that information of the types of hospitals and where they're located?
Most certainly. I have a display on that, Madam Chair, and I'll just give it to Ms. Baker, and she'll distribute it to you.
Thank you.
Because there are 19 of them.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, also, there's a considerable feeling among some of the providers that I've talked to that they're not treated as well as the hospitals are treated in terms of payment from this program. And what sort of, how's that done, you determine the rates?
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, let me guess at what the answer to this is. I believe that the issue has to do with the managed care system where we contract with a provider to subcontract with the various medical service organizations to provide those services. And there has been some concerns that hospitals in that contractual arrangement have been more aggressive in their negotiations with the plans and received a higher benefit, and physicians and some of the other providers may not have had the purchasing power to be.
Well, we need to say to the providers, just be more aggressive in your lobbying. Is that it?
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, the concept was to keep government out of that negotiation and contract for services and let the private sector manage that market-driven process. It hasn't worked as well as you're well in the Portland area. There has been some real issues with risk associated with the benefits received, and we've had to put additional resources in the system in order to maintain the managed care capacity. And so that whole issue is being discussed, not only in Oregon, but nationally, of how we better put the system together to make it rational and also share the risk.
We'll put it to work for medical providers dealing with part of this.
And Madam Chair, Senator Trow, you're probably aware of the amount of work that the governor has gone through in the Portland area to try to figure out a system that works better and use that same model statewide.
Let's hold it.
I think I've covered all the elements in that particular slide, Madam Chair. I do want to have one more conversation about cost growth. Within the Oregon Health Plan, by statute, they are required to have an independent actuary determine what the cost growth is to be, and that independent consultant during this round has been the past is PricewaterhouseCoopers. On average, the 01-03 budget assumes that cost growth for the Oregon Health Plan will increase by 20% over the biennium. And for comparison purposes, during the 97-99-99-01 comparison, the growth was 12%. So the increase has been greater. And when I refer to cost growth, there are three components of that. One is utilization, how often people use a specific service, technology. As technology increases, we have more expensive practices to treat issues, and inflation. And related to that, when you look at cost growth, the governor has talked a lot about the cost growth in drugs. And what I want to do today is give you a comparison to that 61% cost growth that the governor has talked about for prescription drugs relative to some of the other growth categories. This is, I guess, the interactive portion of my presentation. For inpatient, the growth has been around 9%, or expected to be 9% from this biennium to next biennium. If you combined outpatient, physician, and other, the cost growth is around 12%. And then you can see for drugs there, the cost growth has been 61%. So you can see why the governor has some concerns about how the drug budget is driving some of the other issues and decreasing the amount of resources for some of these other programs. And I'd be remiss if I didn't just mention, when we're talking about these program growth or program cuts that the governor has made, moving more to and using some of those resources to move toward a prevention strategy, the governor was very clear when he was looking long term about the revenue expectations for the state of Oregon over the next 10 years and the growth that would take place if we continued with the population and cost growth we've seen in human resources and in other areas of the budget. These are not going to match. And so if we don't get ahead of this through some of the prevention programs, we're going to be back during the 03 session, the 05 session, and all the way through cutting more of these human resource programs or elsewhere in state government. So that is why the governor is trying to get ahead of this and shifting more resources to prevention. He recognizes the impact of some of these cuts to other people in the budget.
Madam Chair.
Senator Yee.
I have a question on Oregon Health Plan. Oregon Health Plan is a demonstration project approved by federal government as a waiver from traditional Medicaid rules. The waiver was granted for 5 years from until January 1999 and extended again to January 2002. So a condition of the waiver was that Medicaid services under Oregon Health Plan would not cost more than the traditional Medicaid. So it's supposed to be budget neutral. So I want to know what was federal government's method of evaluating the original waiver and how do they evaluate the extended waiver?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I'm not even going to come close to answering that question. I know when the original waiver was determined, federal government came in and very carefully looked at the cost of our traditional Medicaid program to create a base. And that base was used on which to evaluate how the initial demonstration project was evaluated. It was determined based on that analysis that it did meet the criteria, the costs were less than the requirement under the federal waiver, and we continue to do that analysis. In the back of my head, Senator Yee, my answer is that we continue to evaluate that comparison, and the existing program is comparable or is costing less than a traditional Medicaid program. Now, the governor would also add that the traditional Medicaid program would be serving a lot fewer people and providing a lot more services, and that under the demonstration project, we are serving a lot more people and maybe providing a few less services, but it's a more rational approach. And in not necessarily as part of his budget, but a plan that he wants to continue forward with is expanding that waiver and asking for additional waivers so we have the flexibility to better use the federal resources more rationally and serve more people throughout the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, follow up. Will you check with Mental Health Division? And what I want to know, what is the criteria and method used by the federal government to evaluate this Oregon Health Plan and compare to the traditional Oregon Health Plan, and what are the cost savings, if there are any?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I will direct that question to Doug Wilson and ask him to get back to you, because I think they're going to have that in-depth conversation with you.
Yes. And how do they evaluate the extended waiver? And how do they monitor the costs? Mm-hmm. Will you give this to Doug Wilson and ask him to
Madam Chair,
answer?
Senator Yee, very definitely I will. I'll make sure he calls you.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the staff and both the Legislative Fiscal Office and DAS for being here. We will, just so that you know, these items that are remaining, they will be rescheduled. It's just that 2 hours is not enough for human services, and there's just so many questions that I think all these members have, and I have spoken with Mr. Stinson to talk about a further discussion. And I understand that we weren't the only group that didn't get completed on time education yesterday, because I think that probably the two areas that individuals are concerned about in the state is the education and the health of our community and welfare of our community. So it's a little wonder that 2 hours is not adequate for having questions and answers and this kind of overview. But I do want to thank you, and I want to apologize to the staff members and those who came here to talk and to share with us your knowledge. But we will have an opportunity to meet with you, and I want you to know that.
Madam Chair, thank you for making that accommodation. I'd like to ask in advance of your perhaps coming back, or you could provide it to the committee later, what you estimate the cost of restructuring the department will be. And what drives my question is that I had the opportunity to personally participate in the restructuring of a state agency and saw firsthand some of the unbelievably high costs associated with the restructuring. Given that this is a very tight budget with a paucity of funds, I'd be curious to see what the anticipation of the actual restructuring of the department is.
It's less.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, we're still in the process of finalizing that, and there's going to definitely be a lot more conversation and definite hearings on the reorganization and all the, not only the costs and savings associated with that, but also the expected outcomes as a result of it.
Thank you very much.
We're adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.